Make sure that you offer him food in strips and chunks that are easy for him to hold, around the same length as his fist. Good first foods are soft vegetables, lightly cooked carrot battens, jacket potato wedges, broccoli florets and fingers of parsnip. Fruits, lightly stewed apple slices, bananas, pear slices and avocado strips, cheese sticks, hard-boiled or scrambled egg, chunks of cooked meat, chicken, beef, ham, and toast fingers. Try to aim for each meal to contain one food that is rich in iron, for instance meat, one that is rich in energy, for instance cheese, and one that is eaten more readily, often carbohydrates. Offer him food when you eat. The more he can watch you eat and copy you, the easier weaning will be. Don't worry about the amount he eats. In the early days, weaning is more about introducing him to the concept of eating solid food than about the quantity consumed. He is likely to squish, smear, and throw the food, which is normal, and actually playing with the food is also part of the learning process, as it helps him to understand the different sensory properties of food. In terms of nutrition, he will get most of what he needs from milk for several more months. View the solids as complementary to his milk, not a replacement for it. He is unlikely to eat 3 full meals a day until sometime after his first birthday. This is normal too. Don't panic when he refuses certain foods, especially vegetables. Just keep re-offering food he has previously refused. It can take hundreds of exposures before he eats certain things, particularly vegetables. Most of all, though, try to trust that he will eat if he is hungry. Don't force him to eat more than he wants, and don't try to hurry him along. Similarly, if he wants more food, even though you think he has already eaten a lot, trust that he knows his body's needs better than you. Weaning really is all about trust. You trusting your baby's needs, and your baby learning to trust his own body's signals. Question. My daughter is 8 months old, and we started baby-led weaning 2 months ago. Up until that point, she was exclusively breastfed, and I'm continuing to breastfeed alongside solids. She has never had milk, breast or formula, from a bottle. She is strong-willed and refuses to be fed. If anyone tries, she purses her lips, moves her head from side to side, and pushes their hand away. I am giving her 3 meals a day, but she is consuming little. It is so frustrating. For breakfast, I offer porridge on a preloaded spoon, or cooled and in thick fingers. Weetabix, fruit, toast, eggs, eggy bread. For lunch, fruit, vegetables, muffins, cheese, puff pastry wheels, etc. And for dinner, whatever my husband and I are eating, if it's baby-friendly, obviously. Sometimes she will have a little, but mostly she pushes the food around, mushes it up and throws it on the floor. She will eat rice cakes and pita breads, and sometimes some fruit such as mango, but that isn't a balanced, nutritious diet. Also, she doesn't really drink any water. I offer it to her from a free-flow cup and a doidy cup, a special open-top cup designed for babies, but she tends to push both away. I have given her the free-flow cup to drink from herself, but she flings it around and barely drinks from it. She won't let me help her to drink either. I am giving her vitamin D drops. I can't help but worry that she's not getting the nutrients she needs, particularly iron, and that she won't get the hang of eating. It's also so disheartening spending lots of time preparing, eating, and cleaning up from meals when she barely eats anything, and so much ends up on the floor and in the bin. Should I be worried? Is there a different approach I can try? Answer. Your daughter sounds perfectly normal to me. Her eating is exactly what I would expect from a baby who has only been eating solids for a couple of months. Allowing her to control her own eating, both the physical aspect of putting food into her mouth and respecting her own hunger and satiety cues, will afford her the very best start to her relationship with food. At this age, she is getting most of the nutrients that she needs from milk, as well as from the vitamin D supplement that you were giving her. The only nutrient that she may be low on currently is iron, as her iron stores from birth will be depleting, and she is not eating much iron-rich solid food. That said, she will absorb around 50% of the iron contained in breast milk, compared to around 10% of that in other foods, even those that are iron-rich. So although levels of iron in breast milk are low, the fact that it is so much better absorbed negates some of the issue. I would suggest that you offer your daughter something containing iron with each meal, and alongside this, I would give her something you know she will eat, and a new or previously refused food. In terms of the amount she eats and what she refuses, you should really try to not worry about this. It is normal for babies to refuse more than they eat initially. Your daughter is learning about her own likes and dislikes, as well as her own hunger and satiety cues. Milk is still her main source of nutrients, not food, and you should view solids as complementary to her milk diet, not a replacement for it. In time, she will begin to consume more, and her tastes will ever so gradually widen. You must learn to trust that she knows when she is hungry and when she is full. Research shows that babies who are weaned using baby-led weaning consume the same amount of energy, calorie-wise, as those weaned using traditional spoon-feeding, but they do grow to have a healthier relationship with food and fewer weight problems. I understand you are questioning your approach right now, but you really have chosen the healthiest route for your daughter. Next, I understand your daughter is squishing, mushing, and throwing food, probably more than she is eating. This, too, is normal, and actually quite necessary. Weaning also involves learning about the textures and sensory properties of foods, and wanting to understand them more. This playing with food has been shown to reduce fussiness and picky eating, and is not something that should be discouraged. In fact, I would encourage it more. If you have any food that is past its best, think about ways that you could use it to allow your daughter more sensory food play. Also, don't be in a rush to clean your daughter up. Wiping away the mess can indicate to her that food is yucky, and you may inadvertently turn her off eating foods with certain textures, creating sensory-based fussiness. Once your daughter is comfortable with the new sensory properties of food, she will begin to taste, and then, finally, swallow it in her own time. Here, the more you can eat with her, sitting together at the table eating the same foods at the same time, the more she will mimic you, and, ultimately, consume more of the food you offer her. I would say most babies get the hang of what you may call proper eating using a baby-led approach by around 10 to 12 months of age. Before this, it really is much more about learning than nutrition. Finally, I wouldn't be concerned by your daughter's refusal of water. Breast milk provides all the liquid she needs. I would keep offering water with each meal, trying a few different cups. Ones with straws are usually quite popular. But I wouldn't make a big fuss over it. Just leave it alongside her and say, "Here's your water." Again, in time, she will drink it, especially if you model drinking your own cup of water at the same time. Question. My little girl is 12 months old, and I'd like to gently wean her off breastfeeding by 14 months at the latest. My reason for weaning is that she will only be fed to sleep. She wakes frequently, and the lack of sleep is taking its toll. I recently had bad flu and pleurisy and still had to do all the nights, so couldn't really rest. I want to be able to share night duties with my husband. Also, I'm 3 stone overweight, and I'd like to get my body back. We tried night weaning for 3 nights with my husband when he was off work. It worked by night 3, and she slept great, but it didn't last, and whenever I go in, she just wants to breastfeed. We tried again this weekend, and she just wouldn't settle for my husband. I can't handle it when she cries. Please help me to gently wean my boob monster. Answer. The gentlest way to end the breastfeeding relationship is to allow the child to lead the way and self-wean. However, I can appreciate that you are ready to end breastfeeding sooner than this. I think it is possible to wean in a way that is kind to your daughter, but I am concerned that you won't get the result that you hope for. While weaning from breastfeeding will mean that others can help to put your daughter to sleep in the evening, giving you a break, it can make getting her to sleep very hard. You may find that bedtimes are much more difficult when you can no longer feed to sleep. Similarly, night weaning doesn't always solve night waking, and sometimes it can make it worse. Also, you may not find weight loss any easier when you are no longer breastfeeding. In fact, the extra calories that you are burning now by breastfeeding may actually mean that you put on weight when you stop. I am aware that so far, my reply sounds very negative, and I am not trying to put you off ending breastfeeding. Rather, I would like you to go into it fully informed with reasonable expectations, and I'm not sure whether your expectations of what life will be like when you are no longer breastfeeding are completely realistic at the moment. If you decide that you do definitely want to go ahead, my recommendation is to wean from feeds in the following order. 1. Night feeds. 2. Daytime feeds that are not immediately before a nap. 3. Daytime feeds that are immediately before a nap. 4. The bedtime feed. You made a good start by beginning with the night feeds and by involving your husband, but it sounds as if your daughter wasn't quite ready when you tried. I would try again by working with one feed at a time, so Dad only settles her once in the night and you breastfeed the other wakes, or by limiting the amount of time Dad attempts to settle it each wake. For instance, he might attempt to settle for 5 or 10 minutes maximum and then you breastfeed. You can stretch the time Dad comforts a little every day until, ultimately, he is comforting for long enough to get your daughter back to sleep without a feed. Once all night feeds have gone, I would take a break for a few days, and then focus on the daytime feeds that are not near to nap times, feeding to sleep. Here, follow similar principles to the night feeds. Once most of the daytime feeds have gone, then I would work on settling her for naps without feeding. Ultimately, you will be left with the bedtime feed. This is by far the hardest feed to lose, as usually it is the one that is the most important to the child. Breastfeeding at bedtime not only calms and provides nutrition, but the milk also contains chemicals that aid sleep. I would therefore recommend that you consider keeping just the bedtime feed for a few months. If you are certain that you want to drop all feeds, however, then I'm afraid you will struggle to get rid of the bedtime feed. You should look to cuddle, rock, stroke, pat your daughter, offer her milk or water from a cup or bottle, and consider giving her a dummy. She will likely cry a fair amount, and bedtime will probably take much longer, so be prepared for this. Focus on staying calm, remind yourself that it's okay that she's upset, and most importantly of all, make sure she is always in arms while she cries. The worst is usually over within the first week, although it may take several months until bedtimes become easier again, but at least you won't be doing it alone, as now others will be able to help. The first few months of eating solids is an important time to practice responsive feeding. Understanding that weaning is not just about nutrition, but also learning and discovery, helps to take some of the pressure off you and your baby. Viewing solids as complementary to, not a replacement for, their main source of nutrition, namely milk, can often enable parents to relax and enjoy the process a little more. Allowing your baby to take control of the process and demonstrating that you trust him to do so, even during the times when not everything is going to plan, sends a strong message to him, and one that will stay with him for years to come. It is a message of belief, respect, and empowerment that will help to instill gentle eating principles for life. Chapter 5. Toddler and Preschooler Eating, 1 to 4 Years. The age group that is most synonymous with eating woes is surely the toddler-preschooler years. Picky eating almost always tops the list here, with some children taking it to extremes, barely eating anything at all and causing endless anxiety for their parents. Some, on the other hand, never seem to stop eating, although often their diet seems to consist solely of beige foods. In this chapter, we will investigate what makes these years the hardest for so many parents. We will ask why picky eating is so common, especially after a good start in babyhood, and consider how you can gently steer your child towards healthy eating habits in the future. Let's start with a quick reminder of the gentle eating principles. Gentle eating is mindful, empowering, respectful, authoritative. In the toddler years, this means being mindful by allowing your child to have as much control as possible over their eating, especially when it comes to their hunger and satiety levels, and also respecting their personal taste preferences, something we will discuss later in this chapter. The aim of gentle eating in toddlerhood is to empower children to become confident and relaxed eaters. Taking an authoritative approach to eating during the toddler years can help to reduce many of the eating issues that children and parents often struggle with later on, such as binging and dieting. Toddlerhood is arguably the most challenging developmental period eating-wise. That's why this chapter focuses almost solely on the common problems and how to cope with them. Whether you are listening to this in advance of the toddler years, or have a toddler who doesn't seem to have any issues with eating, gentle eating principles still very much apply, and I would recommend listening to this chapter in order to be as informed and mindful as possible. When good eater babies become picky eater toddlers. Towards the end of babyhood, parents can often feel confident about their child's eating. After any initial bumps in the weaning road, babies may take to eating solids with gusto. It is common for parents to feel proud about their good eater, the baby with a good appetite who eats a large variety of food, especially those considered to be healthy. By the time he had had his first birthday, my eldest son was one of those good eaters. He would eat practically anything I put in front of him. I remember feeling particularly proud one evening when he ate a whole bowl of sardines, sweet potato, and spinach for dinner. Cooking for him was a joy. I would spend hours steaming organic vegetables that we had delivered as part of a box scheme from a local farm, and he would reward me with gummy smiles of appreciation. I felt like a good mum and thought I had the whole eating thing sorted. I didn't understand why so many parents complained about their child's eating. In fact, I believed that they had brought the problems upon themselves by not offering their child a good range of different tastes and textures, and instead pandering to their children. Oh, how wrong I was. Around 2 months after his first birthday, my good eater son pretty much stopped eating. Foods he had previously wolfed down were left untouched, met with grimaces and tears. My easy baby with the good appetite was replaced with a tricky toddler who would only eat food if it was white, beige, yellow or brown and dry. Sauces were pushed away with disgust, and who acted as if he was being poisoned if anything green came within arm's length. His appetite seemed to shrink in reverse correlation with his growth. The bigger he got, the less he would eat. My baby with the hearty appetite and rolls of comforting fat was replaced by a skinny little boy with the appetite of a sparrow. I no longer felt like such a good mum. In fact, I felt like a complete failure. Each day I felt as if I was failing my son, failing to keep him healthy, failing to provide him with the nutrients he needed to grow big and healthy. Days out with friends, whose toddlers ate, became torture. Lunchtime would come, and while their children ate whatever was put in front of them, my son would push a few raisins and a breadstick around his plate. The other mothers would try to placate me. "Oh, I'm sure he'll be fine, don't worry." But the more I tried not to worry, the more anxious and obsessed with his eating I became. I started to believe that he was doing it on purpose. I begged him to eat, scolded him to eat, bribed and rewarded him to eat. I spent hours trying to hide vegetables and food. I bought special cutlery with aeroplanes on it and pretended to fly the spoon into his mouth. But nothing worked. I only wish I had known then what I know now. It would have saved me, and perhaps more importantly, my son, months of anguish and stress. You see, my son was entirely normal. Now he is a big, burly teenager, scraping 6 feet tall. He eats like a horse, even green foods and foods with sauces. So what did I do to produce this miraculous change in eating habits? How did I turn my non-eating toddler into a healthy teen with a voracious appetite? In truth, I didn't do anything. In fact, it was when I stopped trying to change him, when I relaxed and accepted his eating, that the transformation happened. The most powerful thing I did was to educate myself about eating in early childhood. Once I understood his eating, or rather lack of it, I was able to relax. The causes of picky eating. The most compelling thing I learned about childhood eating as a parent was that picky eating is normal. By normal, I mean there are genuine physiological reasons why it exists, and these are often rooted in keeping the child safe. The relief I felt when I understood that the very behaviour I thought was hurting my son was actually protecting him was immense. I hope I can share some of that relief with you in this section, as I outline some of the top causes of picky eating. Neophobia. Neophobia is used to describe an irrational fear or dislike of anything unfamiliar or new. In the case of eating, it refers to the instant dislike children, particularly toddlers and preschoolers, take to any new foods, even without tasting them. Neophobia is the norm, rather than the exception to the rule, in young children. While it may be incredibly frustrating for parents, especially after they have lovingly prepared a meal to introduce their child to a new taste or ingredient, it is actually important to the child's survival. Think back to a time before food regulation, sanitized food shopping, and ingredients labels. A time when we would have lived in the wild, when we would have hunted or gathered our food ourselves. Hungry children would have foraged for food and eaten what they found. So from an evolutionary perspective, neophobia would have kept young children safe. By avoiding foods that they had not previously eaten, children would avoid any potential toxins found in the new foods. When young children stick to eating only what they know, they demonstrate an important evolutionary throwback. Although the new foods offered by parents today may be completely safe, the child's instinctive drive to refuse them remains unchanged from the one that protected children hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago. Research has shown that most children develop a degree of food neophobia when they turn 2 years old. Predominantly, this means that the toddler will stop accepting new foods that are offered to them, although many also begin to refuse foods that they previously ate. Children are significantly more unlikely to eat foods at 2 years of age that they previously ate as babies. This refusal may be because they don't remember eating the food before, or it may be that they associate the food with a negative experience. Sometimes there is no obvious reason for the refusal, but parents can take heart from the fact that this pattern is very common and very normal and usually entirely temporary, albeit not as temporary as parents would like. Genetics. Another way in which nature protects young children from being accidentally poisoned is to make toxic foods unpalatable. From birth, we favour sweet and savoury tastes and tend to dislike sour and bitter ones. This is no surprise when you realise that most poisonous substances have a bitter taste. Our innate taste preferences help to keep us safe and prevent us from accidentally ingesting foods that could endanger our lives, in a similar way to food neophobia. The only slight flaw in nature's plan is that there is a class of compounds contained in some foods, known as glucosinolates, which are bitter-tasting and can sometimes be toxic, but not always. Safe glucosinolates naturally occur in certain fruits and vegetables, such as broccoli, cabbage, kale, and Brussels sprouts, and many other green vegetables, the very same vegetables that most toddlers and preschoolers dislike so much. Quite simply, there is a very real physiological reason why children don't eat their greens. They are genetically pre-programmed not to, in order to stay alive. All children have a natural aversion to bitter tastes, but some find them much harder to tolerate than others. In fact, some adults struggle significantly with bitter-tasting food too. Perhaps you do. Or perhaps you know an adult who does. Again, the reason is genetic and entirely normal, as we discussed earlier. The bitter compound phenylthiocarbamide, or PTC for short, is detected by a specific taste receptor governed by the TAS2R28 gene. PTC sensitivity is variable, depending on each individual's specific gene encoding, meaning that the ability to detect PTC, or bitterness, is different for everyone. Some people will be sensitive to very small amounts of PTC and have a low tolerance level for bitter tastes as a result, while others will have very low sensitivity and can therefore tolerate very high levels of bitterness. Still others will not be able to detect PTC at all. The ability to taste PTC is closely linked to that for detecting other bitter substances found in nature, such as glucosinolates. Those who are strong tasters, or more commonly dubbed super tasters by the media, are far more sensitive to bitter tastes than others. Strong tasters make up around a quarter of the population, both adult and child. Research has also found that children with high PTC sensitivity are significantly more sensitive to bitter tastes than adults with high PTC sensitivity. Or, in other words, children experience stronger tastes, particularly bitter ones, more than adults, because our sense of taste fades with age. So there is hope that they will venture into consuming them as they grow older, and their sensitivity to bitterness fades. There are likely other genetic factors governing food fussiness too, not just related to bitterness perception. Research looking at the eating habits of 3-year-old twins has shown a significant genetic impact on food fussiness and eating behaviors. Similarly, children who are picky eaters tend to have parents who are picky eaters, especially when considering vegetable intake. While there is clearly a psychological effect when it comes to the impact of modeling and learned behavior, there is also undoubtedly an underlying genetic influence. Too often, we expect our children to eat foods that we don't like very much ourselves, when perhaps we would be better off considering whether they have inherited the same trait responsible for our own dislikes. Autonomy struggles. There are only three aspects of their lives that toddlers and preschoolers can control: sleeping, toileting, and eating. Parents may control almost everything in a child's life, but they cannot make a child sleep, go to the toilet, or chew and swallow food. These things are solely the domain of the child. Why does this matter? Because if a child is struggling with autonomy over their own life, then eating is one of the areas that can become problematic. If they feel suffocated by their schedule, with too many boundaries, too little opportunity for free and independent play, and not enough scope for child-led activities, they often seek to gain the control that they want via their eating. Picky eating may sometimes have its roots in a totally different aspect of the child's life, although there is often a lack of autonomy felt around actual eating, too. A good example here is to think about what you ate yesterday. Think about each particular item you ate. Who chose it? Who chose how you ate it, when you ate it, the temperature it was served at? What about where you ate it and the portion size? Who decided when you had had enough? Or if you had more? The chances are that your answer to all of these questions was me. Now consider the same questions, only this time in relation to your child. We may think that we are giving children control over their eating, but we're not, or not much, anyway. Parents often say to me, "But I always give my child a choice. I ask if they want pasta or fish, a cheese or a ham sandwich, cornflakes or porridge." In response, I always ask the parents to imagine themselves in a restaurant. They are given a menu to choose from and expect to see perhaps 10 different options for each course, maybe more. Upon opening the menu, however, they find only two choices: chicken done one way or a vegetarian lasagna. I then ask them, what would they think of that menu? Would they consider it a good one? Or would they exclaim, "Wow, what a poor choice, only two different options"? Now ask yourself again if you are really giving your child a good choice when you let them choose between two different options to eat. Of course, you can't prepare a restaurant-worthy menu every day, but getting your child involved in selecting food when you purchase it, offering at least three different options at each meal, and allowing the child to select how much of each meal component they would like on their plate when it comes to serving, provides a much better level of choice and control than simply, "Do you want this or that?" We don't just take away control over what a child eats, though. We also control how they eat it. Fingers or cutlery, but only with specific foods. Sometimes fingers are okay, sometimes they're not. Where they eat it? At the table. What time they eat it? Lunchtime is at 12 o'clock, dinner is at 5 o'clock. The types of food they eat at specific times? Cereal for breakfast, sandwiches for lunch, never the other way round. The order they eat the food in? Dessert always comes after dinner, not before. The temperature it's served at? Eat your food quickly before it gets cold. And what constitutes an acceptable blend of foods? No, you can't have fish fingers with custard. Don't be silly. We also tend to override our children's hunger and satiety. "You can't be hungry, you only just ate dinner." Or, "You can't be full up, you've barely eaten anything all day." As well as not truly respecting their taste preferences. "Oh, it's lovely. How can you say you don't like it? Just eat a bit more." Research has shown that the more controlling a parent is about their child's eating, the fussier the child will become. Even those who feel they are giving their child as much control as possible over their eating most likely aren't. Giving more control back to the child is an important consideration when trying to improve picky eating. Sensory struggles. When we think about toddlers and preschoolers refusing certain foods, we generally think it's because they don't like the taste. While this is undoubtedly true, particularly for bitter-tasting foods, it isn't the only reason. Sometimes children may not like the smell of a certain food or how it looks, but how it feels is often a stumbling block at this age. It is not uncommon for young children to refuse foods that are wet or slimy in some way. As I have mentioned previously, my firstborn refused any food in a sauce as soon as he hit toddlerhood, eschewing wet food for the accompanying dry breadsticks, crackers, and toast at all opportunities. To this day, only one out of four of my children will eat mushrooms, not because of their taste, but their texture. Apparently, they are all squidgy and make their teeth feel funny. I initially thought this was a strange quirk of my family, until I realized how many others, not just children, but adults too, share this disdain. Research into the eating habits of toddlers and preschoolers has found that the texture of food influences picky eating significantly more than color or taste. Further research has found a strong link between the sensory processing characteristics of children and the food that they eat, or rather don't eat. For those children who do not have a specific sensory processing disorder, a specific condition where they struggle with sensory input, I wonder if this shunning of wet, slimy, and squelchy foods in favor of their safe, dry counterparts is because of the way we speak about different textures as adults. Words like slimy and squelchy are used to describe monsters and aliens and other unpleasant creatures. Many parents can unconsciously pass on a fear of dirt to their children by constantly wiping their faces or hands, whether it is to clean them of snot, ketchup, chocolate, or mud. So our dislike of certain textures and the dirt and negativity associated with them must surely rub off on our children. Is this, perhaps, why so many of them avoid similar textures when it comes to eating? Evolutionary eating. Many years ago, when we lived a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, or even a scavenger one, our eating would have been very different from how it is today, not just in terms of the actual food eaten, but also in the way we ate it. Our ancestors would not have had three regular meals a day, for their eating depended solely upon what they hunted, gathered, or scavenged. Simply, they would have eaten when they could, when food was available. There would have been times of scant food offerings, when they would have gone several hours, if not days, without eating, followed by times of plenty, when they could eat to their heart's content. And so it makes sense, when food is available, to eat as much as possible, a feast to counteract the famine that may be just around the corner. This opportunistic eating and intermittent fasting is in line with 5-2 eating, a trendy new healthy eating ethos. However, toddlers and preschoolers have been doing it for years, long before anybody had even heard of 5-2. Quite simply, toddlers and preschoolers eat in the same way as our ancestors, feasting when they come across a food that they enjoy, and fasting when there is nothing on offer that takes their fancy. As a toddler, my daughter used to feast and fast every day, not dependent on the food on offer, but rather the time of day. She used to eat with gusto in the mornings, so much so that she would be on her third breakfast of the day by 10 a.m. and begging for lunch at 11. But when the clock struck one, no more food would pass her lips until the next morning. At first, I panicked that she didn't eat anything in the afternoon, and regularly turned her nose up at dinner. However, when I considered what she had eaten in the day, it was the same in terms of quantity as it would have been had she eaten at more regular times. It just so happened that she did all her eating in a 5-hour period, preferring to fast in the afternoons and evenings, ready for her next feast the following morning. We need to think about why we feel that our children must eat at certain times. Isn't the fact that they are eating what they need, whenever they eat it, more important? Parental anxiety. As a parent of a previously picky eater, I understand how stressful it is. When my son was younger, I spent hours every day worrying about his eating. I swung from thinking that he was somehow trying to manipulate me and was refusing to eat on purpose, to berating myself for being an awful parent. There were many times that I blamed myself. I felt that I had surely done something wrong. Had I made a mistake when weaning him? Was my cooking unpalatable? Was I placing too much pressure on him to eat? Or perhaps I needed to get stricter and force him to eat? I remember distinctly how hopeless it made me feel. Why couldn't I get him to eat? Would he ever eat again? Would he grow sick because of malnutrition? Would I be seen as a negligent parent? I bribed my son, begged him, scolded him when he didn't eat, and spent hours cooking things to tempt him. If I had read or heard about a method somewhere, then I tried it. Nothing worked. With each failed attempt and discarded meal, I became more and more anxious, stressed, and scared. Ironically, I realize now that in stressing about my son's eating, I had created a self-fulfilling prophecy and made his eating even more picky. Research has shown that when mothers are concerned about their children under-eating, they are more likely to pressure or bribe their children to eat, behavior which, in turn, is associated with an increase in picky eating. The more controlling I was around my son's eating, the less he ate. When I relaxed and just accepted him as he was, picky eating and all, I noticed a very small, positive effect on his eating. Lifting the pressure slowly encouraged him to eat a little more, and month by month, his pickiness began to subside. It was not a quick change by any means. It took several years until I no longer considered him picky. But we were both happier, and he did, eventually, grow out of it. Solutions for picky eating. While being picky is completely normal and natural for young children, there are still several things that parents can do to slowly encourage less fussy eating. None of these is a quick-fix solution. In fact, trying to rush any changes will ultimately backfire, making eating worse. So it is important that you have realistic expectations when it comes to a time frame. Don't think in terms of days or even weeks, but months and years. Although the results you do get, while slow to appear, will be the healthiest and most long-lasting. Remember, the goal of gentle eating is to create healthy eating habits for life. Hold the praise and rewards. Praising a child for eating can be incredibly counterproductive. While the child may initially try to eat the food on offer, in order to earn lots of praise from their parents, the effect is unlikely to be long-lasting. And more worrying is how it encourages children to override their innate satiety cues in favor of pleasing their parent. Research has shown that children who are regularly praised for eating are statistically more likely to grow to be overweight in later life. Being praised for eating encourages the child to associate it with feeling good. It is no surprise, then, that this emotional eating leads to disordered eating as the child grows and seeks to eat to make themselves feel better. In a similar vein, rewarding for good eating is also best avoided. Rewards may temporarily make a child eat more, but they can also have a negative effect on whether the child actually likes the food and can cause an aversion to previously liked foods. This unintended negative outcome is even more likely to occur if the reward on offer is another food, for instance, if the child is rewarded with ice cream for eating their broccoli. Eating really should be emotion-free. That means no praise and no rewards. The goal of gentle eating is to raise a child who has a healthy relationship with food, one who eats when they are hungry and stops when they are full, and considers all food as fuel, not naughty or good. When we reward or praise a child for eating up, clearing their plate, or even trying something, we encourage them to override their own bodily cues. They may temporarily eat a little more, or try something green, but this does not mean you are instilling good eating habits. As a parent, your role is to stay neutral about the food the child eats. That means you don't reward or praise when they eat well, and you don't admonish them if they don't eat something either. Remove the pressure. When your child doesn't eat, or constantly refuses a certain food, it can be really hard not to prompt them to just try one forkful, or comment negatively that they never try anything. Gentle eating is about taking a responsive, compassionate, and authoritative approach. That means taking a step back and allowing the child to take more control over their eating. It can be easy to slip into an authoritarian style of parenting when you are worried about your child's eating, but the pressure that comes with such an approach will always mean it backfires. Research has shown that children who are pressured to eat by their parents eat significantly less than those who are not, and they are more likely to avoid the foods that they are being pressured to eat. So while you may be tempted to cajole your child into taking just one more bite, the best way to reduce picky eating is to keep quiet and remove any pressure. If you feel the need to say something, then saying, "You don't have to eat it if you don't want to," is far more empowering and far more likely to result in a positive outcome. Don't give up. As children grow, their tastes change, and their dislike of bitter foods, in particular, will subside a little. Liking a food is not only related to taste, though. A child's experiences will also affect which foods they choose to eat. For this reason, one of the most powerful things you can do is to keep representing the challenging food. There is a myth that it takes 10 or 15 exposures to a food for a child to try it or begin to like it. Aside from the fact that it's mentioned in thousands of articles, books, and websites, unattributed to any source, I can find no evidence for this. In reality, it may take hundreds of exposures before your child attempts and, ultimately, likes a certain food. It may take years. How often have you heard an adult say things like, "I hated Brussels sprouts as a child. I didn't start eating them until I was in my 20s. Research does show that repeated exposure to a food increases the chance that your child will eat it, but it is important that you remember to stay calm and avoid placing any pressure on them to actually try it. I find the best way to approach repeated food exposure is to accept that it will almost always result in repeated refusal. And if you don't expect your child to try the food, then you are not disappointed when they don't, which, in turn, helps to keep your stress levels down. If they do try it, then it is a happy miracle. One step at a time. When it comes to types of food that you know your child isn't keen on, offering only one of them at a time provides the least stress for you and your child. So if your child usually refuses green vegetables, for example, only serve one type. Putting cabbage and peas on their plate at the same time is likely to lead to anxiety and stress for you both. Presenting just peas, or just cabbage, however, is likely to be much more successful. In addition to only offering one challenging food at a time, make sure you always offer something that you know your child will eat. Their plate should ideally always comprise one new or challenging food, one that they are neutral about, and one that they are almost guaranteed to eat. Being presented with food in this manner means the child should feel more relaxed, and a more relaxed child is one who is more likely to try something new or challenging. Remember to remain emotionless about what your child chooses to eat. Don't prompt them to try the new food or praise them for eating the challenging food. Give them some control. Gentle eating is about empowering your children and respecting their likes and dislikes, satiety and hunger. In essence, this means giving them control over their eating. As adults, we may not realize how little control our children have over their food intake on a daily basis, because we take the control over our own eating for granted. Giving your child more say over their eating can be a wonderfully empowering way to reduce pickiness and increase food intake. Most importantly, you need to honor your child's likes and dislikes. Too often, parents unconsciously try to force their own food preferences onto their children. Comments such as, "Don't be silly, it's lovely," can quickly creep into your daily dialogue without you realizing. It's okay for children to like foods that we don't, and dislike foods that we may love. A lovely way to honor your child's dislikes and give them more control is to place an empty bowl on the table when you eat. Call it the unwanted food bowl, and if anybody in your family really doesn't like something on their plate and doesn't want to try it, they are allowed to put it in the unwanted food bowl, no questions asked. Similarly, using serving bowls that children can serve themselves from, rather than you putting food directly on their plates, allows them to select the food they would like in differing amounts. As well as likes and dislikes, we must honor our children's hunger and satiety. If we want to raise children with healthy eating habits, we must understand how important it is for them to recognize and respect their bodily cues. If a child only eats a few mouthfuls and then declares that they're not hungry, far too often we reply with something like, "Of course you're hungry. You haven't eaten for ages and you've been running around all afternoon. You need to eat, so eat up." We deny them the opportunity to self-regulate their eating. Around 85% of parents prompt their children to eat regularly, an alarming figure considering that children whose parents overly control their food intake in early childhood grow to favor high-fat and high-energy foods, struggle to control their eating, and have a more restrictive diet than those who are given the freedom to eat in line with their own preferences and satiation levels. Allowing your child to control their own eating, both what they eat and how much of it, may seem like a scary concept, and many parents worry that their child will accidentally starve or consume only food with low nutrient levels. But scientists have found that young children actually eat a fairly well-balanced diet when left to their own devices. Although food intake at individual mealtimes may be erratic, young children do seem to eat a well-balanced diet when their food consumption over a 24-hour period is calculated. Time to get messy. For children who struggle with the sensory aspects of eating, especially foods that are slimy, mushy, and gooey, incorporating more messy play into their days, focusing on the sensations that they struggle with, can help them with food acceptance. Research has shown that sensory play with real fruits and vegetables can have a positive impact on children's fruit and vegetable consumption. The experiment, conducted with 3- and 4-year-olds, found that children who had played with fruit and vegetables in a messy play session tried significantly more of them than those who had not. This finding proved true not only for the specific fruit and vegetables that they had played with, but also those that they hadn't. Parents of children who struggle with getting messy, and often avoid messy foods as a result, should also focus on their own behaviour. If you are overly clean, you can unconsciously pass on a fear of mess to your children. Parents who make a dash for the baby wipes as soon as their toddler puts their hands in their food, or when they get as much of what they are eating on their face as in their mouth, can cause their child to become anxious about making a mess with food. In turn, this may lead to picky eating, especially when it comes to food with messier textures. If you can identify yourself in this, try to find a way to keep the baby wipes in the packet and postpone the hand washing. When you do clean up your child, be careful to not use words like messy or mucky. Instead, saying something like, "Wow, you look like you enjoyed that. You were so excited to eat it, it's gone everywhere." Picture perfect. Imagine that you are on holiday and are served something that you don't recognize. You don't speak the language, so are unable to ascertain what the food is. All you know is that it doesn't look like anything you have ever seen or eaten before. Would you be just a little reluctant to try it? Now imagine living this scenario every day, and I think you'll begin to understand how toddlers and preschoolers feel. Helping children to familiarize themselves with new and different foods can help to reduce neophobia and any anxiety surrounding them. Research has found that looking at books containing pictures of food helps toddlers to be more adventurous when trying them for the first time. Together with a parent, children aged between 19 and 26 months looked at a book containing pictures of unfamiliar fruits or vegetables every day for 2 weeks. At the end of the fortnight, researchers determined whether the book exposure had had any impact on the eating behavior of the children. They found that it had, significantly so, with the toddlers consuming more of the unfamiliar vegetables they had seen in the book when compared to others that they had not seen. This research has wonderful implications for parents. If you can find a book with one of your child's favorite characters as well, I suspect the result would be even more powerful. Mirror, mirror. Children learn how to behave by mimicking us. They watch us day in, day out, and look to us to learn what to do in different situations, eating being one of them. As a parent, your eating behaviors and likes and dislikes are paramount when it comes to influencing your child's preferences. Think about the message you are giving to your child when you take the crusts off your bread, push your vegetables around your plate, or ask a restaurant to hold the salad. Think too about what you convey when you refer to sweet foods as yummy, naughty, or a treat. Research has shown that toddlers and preschoolers are more likely to try a new food if an adult is eating the same food at the same time. Further research has found that this, modelling, is the most successful way of encouraging a child to eat. Modelling has a more significant impact on child eating than prompting them to eat, rewarding them, or rationalizing with them about eating. You need to eat your vegetables to be healthy. If you don't eat them, you won't grow big and strong. The problem with modelling is that as well as eating the same food at the same time, it also requires us, as parents, to slow down and sit down to eat with our children, something that often doesn't happen if parents work and the children are at daycare. Try to find time to eat at least one meal every day with your child, and at weekends aim for all meals. If you are not eating your meal at the same time as your child, serve yourself a small snack of the foods that your child is struggling with and eat that with them. Modelling really does have such a powerful effect on toddler and preschooler eating that it is worth making the time to do it as often as possible. Honour their inner caveman. Earlier in this chapter, we discussed the opportunistic eating and intermittent fasting patterns commonly followed by young children. While this eating pattern is entirely normal and quite healthy, it is clearly at odds with the modern construct of 3 square meals a day. If you have a toddler or a preschooler who suits the eating patterns of the Paleolithic era far more than those of the 21st century, the easiest solution is to swap your modern eating expectations for something more instinctive and in keeping with their habits. Allowing your child to eat at any time they feel hunger usually results in them eating significantly more and usually more healthily than if you try to make them fit in with socially accepted mealtimes. And one of the best ways to accomplish this is to embrace the idea of a grazing tray. Grazing trays are simply containers of some description containing a variety of foods that the child can select from whenever they feel the need to eat. They may return to the tray frequently and eat little and often throughout the course of the day, in a gatherer style, or they may eat a large quantity far less frequently, mimicking more of a hunter style. Either way, the amount consumed over a 24-hour period is usually more than they would have eaten at regular breakfast, lunch, and dinner times, especially if you also mirror eating the same foods. To make a grazing tray, you need an appropriate container. One with individual compartments tends to work best, or you can buy special plates with different compartments. The insert from a fishing or toolbox works very well too, and is usually much cheaper, or a couple of large ice cube trays also work. The aim is to fill each compartment with a different food. Suggestions for foods that work well are carrot sticks, cucumber battens, cherry tomatoes cut in half, sweet pepper strips, grapes cut in half, raisins, mini breadsticks and hummus, cubes of cheese, hard-boiled eggs, quartered, mini falafels, sushi rolls, without raw fish, ham or chicken strips, fresh raw peas, mini crackers with cheese spread, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries and blackberries, apple and pear slices, edamame beans, pickles, mini sandwiches, avocado strips, cold penne pasta tubes, sweet corn kernels, cashew nuts and walnuts. At the start of each day, place freshly prepared food in the tray and leave it while your child has free and easy access. Independent access is an important feature of the grazing tray, which usually rules out storing it in the fridge. Most toddlers and preschoolers are unable to easily open a fridge door and take a tray out without adult assistance. As the tray will not be chilled, be sure not to put it near a radiator or fire. It will usually be fine to leave most foods out for 3 or 4 hours without them spoiling, but you may well need to refresh the contents 2 or 3 times each day. You may also consider resting the tray on cool packs to prolong the life of the food. When you first begin to use a grazing tray, it may not seem as if your child is eating very much. However, if you keep track of what you have put out each day, you will probably find that they have eaten significantly more than you thought. Some parents use a grazing tray in place of all meals. Others use them just for the middle of the day, offering a regular breakfast in the morning and dinner at the end of the day. Whichever way you use them, grazing trays are an effective, child-friendly, and gentle way to encourage healthier eating. Full focus. All too often, our busy lives mean that we eat on the run. We rarely focus fully on eating, and yet this is exactly what is needed if we want to encourage good habits in our children. Eating with full focus means being more aware of our body's hunger and satiety cues. It encourages mindful eating, whereas distracted eating encourages the opposite. Whether they are sitting at a table to eat a full meal, or grazing from a selection of foods throughout the day, children should eat with their full focus on their food. That means no snacks in a buggy, lunch on the go in the car, or eating in front of the television or while being entertained by other screens or toys. It also means that food is not used to distract them from potentially difficult behavior. The big emotions underlying the difficult behavior mean that children will never be able to fully concentrate on eating, while the use of food as a distraction technique is not only poor discipline, but potentially encourages disordered emotional eating in the future. Knowing that children mirror our eating behavior, parents should be especially aware of where their own focus is during eating. This means turning off the television, shutting the laptop, and putting down your mobile phone to focus fully on your own food. Try to relax. Being the mother of a non-eater or a fussy eater is certainly the most difficult aspect of parenting I had to face. No other issue has affected me quite so much or made me feel so utterly hopeless. And with that hopelessness came self-doubt, guilt, and heaps of anxiety. Anxiety is catching. No matter how much I tried to approach mealtimes with a smile on my face, my son could sense my dread. Of course, he picked up on it. My anxiety feeding his own eating anxiety in a never-ending cycle. Research has confirmed that parental anxiety is associated with fussy eating in preschoolers, and the same is undoubtedly true for toddlers. Worrying about your child not eating makes you anxious, which, in turn, creates a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby the child does not eat. It is a cycle that must be broken. As I mentioned earlier, my son's eating ultimately improved when I managed to relax and go with it. I accepted my son for all he was, picky eating and all. In so doing, I took the pressure off him and off myself. I dropped my expectations to a level where I was pleased if he ate anything, even one tiny nibble or crumb. I ditched the praise, the rewards, the pressure, the prompting, and I just let him be. I made eating unemotional. I took deep breaths before every meal and reminded myself it was okay if he didn't eat. It wasn't about me. I was not failing. I was doing the best I could. I won't pretend it was easy. It wasn't. But the more I practiced my newfound zen-like demeanor, the easier it was to step into those chilled-out shoes for real, until ultimately, I found I wasn't pretending anymore. The calmer I became, the more my son ate. It wasn't quick, but there was change, and I was happy with any tiny speck of hope. Other common toddler and preschooler eating concerns. While picky eating is the most universal issue with toddler and preschooler eating, it is by no means the only worry of parents of 1 to 4-year-olds. There are a few other concerns that are raised quite frequently, namely worries about table manners, or rather lack of them, how to cope when your child wants to eat all the time, what to do when pudding holds far more interest than savory food, and what to do when children are in daycare where eating is approached in a different way. Let's take a look at each of these in turn. Table manners. Young children and table manners are not necessarily terms you would commonly associate with each other. Despite this, table manners remain a top concern among parents the world over, whether it's about children throwing food, playing with food, not using cutlery, refusing to sit in a high chair, making strange noises while eating, or refusing to sit still while others finish eating. Before we look at how to cope with specific issues surrounding table manners, We must consider whether or not our expectations of young children are appropriate for their age. As adults, we can understand social rules and niceties. We appreciate the consequences of not following them, and we can empathize with others who may be offended by non-compliance. We also have the neurological development necessary to control our own impulses and behavior, meaning that we can stop ourselves from doing something if we feel that others